The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, BM pushes into AIS and ACF too. John follows the money. Fraud, spies, and lies go global. Simpson goes back to school. Doug manages the risk, and AI starts to get headaches, and much more, only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Friday, April 28th, all afternoon, the CSUMB Startup Challenge finalists will be at the Otter Student Union. Contact the IIED at the university for details. Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. To sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. Headlines from this week. North Korean attackers hit critical infrastructure organizations. An anti-ransomware platform got $50 million of funding. An abandoned WordPress plugin is being abused for backdoor deployments. Google Cloud platform vulnerabilities have led to stealthy account backdoors. Think things are heating up? Yeah, no kidding.
Friends, this is T-Texas Tyler with a strange story about a soldier boy and a deck of cards.
During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
I went to White Plains to work on IBM's advanced administrative system, where I developed the access control facilities for that system.
Is that like ACF?
Yeah, except that ours was list-based and ACF2 was rules-based. So,
yeah. Well, hang on. So did yours have a name?
No, it was a subsystem of IBM's advanced administrative system, which was a system that connected all the branch offices to the ordering and billing and accounts receivable functions, all that stuff. This was in the 60s, and I got to the point that I was making a lot of presentations on two things. One was how we managed this mammoth system at that time, and two, on security.
So wait, before you go into the future of this mammoth system, how mammoth was the system at that time?
Well, it had four system 360 model 65s and an 85 for the database.
Yep, and how big was the database? How big were the data sets, number of users, locations, and so forth?
There were 5,000 users and located all around the U.S. And in branch offices, they were mostly administrative people who were the users of the system.
Yeah, okay. So that mammoth at that time, that was pretty mammoth. That might be like the biggest network in the world except for the military networks, right?
Well, the management of that system came mostly from the development of the IBM Sabre system for American Airlines. So
which lasted for a long time, right? That was still around after 2000, right? Is it still around today?
Oh, it's still around. The application is still around.
And that's still doing the airline reservations, right?
Yeah, except that reservations today turns out to be a relatively small part of airline IT, as you probably know from recent occurrences, Aircraft scheduling and all that stuff is the really hard problem these days.
Well, and then the in-flight stuff.
So, of course, Bill has me thinking about Unisys, right? And, you know, in those, my Unisys years always think about this because I just venerate Grace Hopper and the work she's done and so forth. And when I realized, you know, halfway through my Unisys tenure, that her code is still running, you know, that Citibank is still running it, you know, that the big Burroughs computers and so forth, you know, that Unisys was selling Citibank, you know, decades ago, are physically gone, but the code still exists. And it's running an emulation on, like, you know, massive arrays of Dell Intel servers. So it's still out there.
Saber is still in day-to-day use, 60 right. years. It's been 60 years. When we talk about the evolution of software, you know, people converted. Y2K was a huge conversion process, right? A lot of conversions, but a lot of stuff is still running from prior to that. And now people keep changing the languages, next language, next language. I committed to Java after it was operational for a while, but it's now basically deprecated into nothingness. And now I write some stuff in JavaScript. But, you know, Perl has been around a lot longer than any of those things. Right. And mainframes are still, you know, running enormous amounts of code, but, you know, they're now in a pizza box. They used to take, you know, a building, but the same code is running for a very long time, longer than people live. So one of the interesting things here is that computer software, not the hardware, but the software, the mental stuff is still running, and it will be running, you know, it might be running for thousands of years. And when you talk about creating infrastructure, and this is the old story of the railroad, you know, why are the railroad gauges whatever width they are in the United States and around most of the world? It's the same sort of story. And we're not going to tell the story here. I'll tell it separately. But so here's, now, then he has the security system. And the security system is running on lists, basically access control lists, as right. opposed to roles and rules. Okay, this is the 1960s. Okay. And here we are today, and roles and rules still out there. We're going to talk to Doug Simmons at some point, and he'll talk about roles and rules and you know, role-based access control, RBAC, which is still considered the most widely used approach for a variety of reasons we can talk about when the subject comes up. And then there's now attribute-based access control, ABAC, but it's the same sort of thing. And we're going to hear more from Bill on this, but I just I thought this is just fascinating how long these things last.
Well, we had to, over these spans of times, we have to understand, you know, the impact of open systems. Because back in those days, yeah, you know, everything's isolated, everything's a silo and so forth. Technology doesn't cross paths. And today, the exact opposite. We have open standards, open source, right? And it's anyways. It's just a fascinating, you know, that part of the evolution, right?
Well, and the closed source stuff still works, and it's reliable, and I don't hear a whole lot of new vulnerabilities, you know, popping up in the Saber code.
Well, I remember now the story that triggered was, you know, the derivative work sort of issue of open source, right? You know, you're not writing everything from scratch. And, you know, Bill's story reminds me of, you know, my first web page. You know, cchudge.com, because cchange.com is too long. You didn't use that many characters. Yeah, S-E-A-C-H-D. And there was a web page I saw called All the Web Servers in the World and had 25 things on it. I figured out how to save the page, you know, edit it in VI, you know, learned HTML, you know, deleted some things, replaced some of the things and posted it, right?
There was also the site called The End of the Internet. And then there was another site that popped up shortly after that, The Other End of the Internet. So now you could bound the thing. And I got all.net, you know, all.net pretty early on. That was like, it was in the 90s. But, you know, that's long after when I was using the computers in the ARPANET. So all the names changed. And they're changing again. Nowadays, we just had a presenter recently that talked about their game software. And it has whatever it is, .ai is the name of the game. It's the name of the game. But there's a AI domain. But if you look at the name under the domain, it's a different thing. So now we're going to crowd the namespace again, you know, so overlaying names on names. We know the havoc that wreaks in programming. Now we're going to be wreaking it in the domain space where they created all the extra domain names.
It'll all work out.
Yeah, more havoc. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One.
We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
With every death comes honor. With honor, redemption.
The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
We're back with you, John. And so you're working for Howard Hughes in his great big building where he has all these insane, crazy records and owned most of Nevada and so forth. So what happened next in your career?
Well, I actually worked for Hughes Aircraft Company, and I was detailed for that project. That project lasted for about 6 months, as I recall. And when it was over, then I went back to Hughes Aircraft, which was in Hawthorne. And about 6 months after that, I got transferred to the I got promoted to security and safety manager for the Santa Barbara Research Center, which was wholly owned by Hughes Aircraft. And it was our infrared technology research center. And that was my real first major introduction and responsibility for national security programs in those days.
So can you tell us anything about those programs, or is that not allowed?
Well, there were a few programs that have since been declassified. One of the programs that came out of Santa Barbara was, you may recall during the Vietnam War, that we monitored a lot of trails and in various parts of Vietnam and other sundry countries in that area. You know, we made the IR detectors that were dropped from airplanes to monitor those trails. And that detector could tell you how many, which way they were going, et cetera. So it was a...
And was this in real time? It would report to you this many people are coming down this trail in that direction?
Right. There was a lag time.
Was it video or just counts or what?
Well, it was IR. If you've ever seen something that looks like an IR image, that's what it was. So it was hard to tell whether it was a man, a woman, you know, et cetera. You couldn't get physical descriptions out of it.
For example, if they were carrying a gun, right?
Depending on how they were carrying it. If they were carrying it, you know, on their side, you wouldn't see it. If they were carrying it over their shoulder with a bayonet on it, you get a chance to see it.
You could also presumably detect things like motorcycles and other kinds of light vehicles, right?
Oh, yeah. There were very few vehicles on most of those trails, at least at that time. And motorcycles and bicycles were about the only thing that, was the only mode of transportation. They did have a few ox carts that was pulled by rather large ox, and you could distinguish between them and
So that's one example, but presumably there were lots of those things, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds of different technologies that might have been there that you were, so you were in charge of the security for that, right?
For that program, right. We were selling those to the military. And so once we delivered them to the military, our operational responsibilities took them through manufacturer testing and then field testing. And once they were field tested, because that would be done on a military installation someplace, once they were done with field testing, then the ownership passed to the military and they used them as they saw fit.
This was all physical security, right? It was all about, it was information security, but it was physical in nature, right?
Well, from the detector point of view, yes, but the collection of information and the analysis of the information collected was all information. There was very little physical security associated with that, other than we were in secure areas where that information was used.
But you were also presumably in charge of personnel security for the people working on the program, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, in charge of personnel security for the Hughes elements. The military elements that took care of their own.
Yeah, so all the people at Hughes, you were in charge of counterintelligence and every aspect of it, right?
Not in the beginning, but it became that way. As my skill set expanded,
That of course included various kinds of elicitation against your folks that you were countering, right?
Yes.
And so this is now we're talk about influence operations today, but elicitation is an influence operation, right?
Oh, sure.
So you were doing influence operations and counter influence operations in the 1960s and 70s. That's basically right.
Well, yeah, I was counterintelligence. Actually, counterintelligence, as we know it today, essentially matured into a discipline during the Vietnam War. And there was a program called the Purple Dragon. And the Purple Dragon was what counterintelligence was trying to address. And that was the adversaries collecting what would otherwise be unclassified information, aggregating that information, and deducing something that was sensitive.
Yeah, the puzzle problem, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent.
And so, yeah, I kind of grew up in that vein, although until well after the war, it wasn't actually exploited in the civilian world, in the civilian national security world. Now, the agency had a very mature program.
Yeah, when you say the agency, you're talking about the Central Intelligence Agency, right?
Central Intelligence Agency, right.
The three-letter agency, that's right.
Well, yeah, now we start to find out, where he was working. So,
yeah, I love this, the narrative over time, right? Sun Tzu said many thousands of years ago that the key to conflict is to remove the willingness to resist on your opponent. And I use this analogy kind of all the time, in life and business. By the time my opposition sees me, I want them to see me in every direction and then just give up, right? Whatever it is, right? And you follow through John's example there in the timeline he's talking about into my world, to where we are today. And not only are influence operations getting relatively well known, but I mean the capital I influencer. Literally everyone on earth now, I think, knows this one, right? There are people out there making really good careers being influencers. I follow a guy, Will, who does solar power teardowns and lots of reviews, he influences my decisions, right? You know, influence operations have always been a thing, you know, hold my coffee.
Yeah, well, the old boys network, you know, and so forth. But I think first thing to point out here is we're talking the 1960s and 70s. This is 60 years ago.
Right.
Okay. And they are developing the underlying understandings and mechanisms. And then you have stuff like the, you know, the program's called Purple Dragon. Okay. You know, just, you know, that's one of those names they came up with. And you got to wonder, why was it purple, right? Was it about the Reds and the Blues, you know, and the dragon is the Chinese thing. So, you know, maybe this was about China and Russia in that time frame, wild guess. But there are all these other sort of aspects that are coming into existence. So computers, remember, before that time, computers were, you know, very isolated and barely used in the world, you know, from World War II. But now, by this time frame, you had these mainframes. So they had a bunch of mainframes sitting in a big building, and there is no computer security. There's no mechanism, no function. There's physical security. There's operations security, which they knew about, and personnel security, right? And now they're starting to talk about information security. So this is, it's not that the function wasn't performed. It was performed, but there was no discipline. There was no mechanism. And John is there doing this for, you know, what he didn't give us numbers, but many, many programs, right? And then the other thing that strikes me is that, well, one or two of them are no longer classified. So that probably means there are another 60 he worked on in the 1960s that are still classified.
Well, I really think sometimes that we, in many ways, went back a step in the cybersecurity age, right? You know, because, yeah, as I say, security and conflict and so forth go back literally forever. You know, nation state, you know, entities, political entities of all sorts, you know, from HOAs to you know, major nations have understood this for millennia, right? You know, how do I get things done? I, you know, create influence operations. And, you know, the sidestep into technology where security people, you know, engineers become security people by default because something breaks or there's a weakness and everybody looks around. And it's like, oh, you engineer, you figured how to build this. You know, what's the security flaw, right? And yeah, you know, in cybersecurity, we use a phrase, social engineering, to this day, to sum up all of human activity, right? You know, if it's not an on-off switch, it's just social engineering. You know, in a military conflict, social engineering is, you know, the fake, you know, World War II, the fake tanks and everything else that convinced Hitler that, you know, Winston Churchill was going to launch D-Day from a different part of the world, right? It's everything.
So yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the reason we have war is because of influence, right? It's because people are convinced. Who, without that convincing, what would ever get you to leave your family, pick up a gun, and go to a place where people are killing each other and try and kill people while they're trying to kill you? That's just not something that you or I would do if it wasn't for this influence operation creating the we and them and the hatred and the everything else, the dehumanization and so forth.
Well, so it works at the top as well, you know, whether it's a CEO or you know, a national dictator, right? You know, the efforts to influence them, you know, form the information space that they live in, get them to do things. You know, that's been a known mechanism, you know, in conflict since caveman days, right? Seriously.
And negotiations, yeah, that's how negotiations works, right? Yeah, so clearly, and when we talk about cyber systems, cybernetic systems, we talk about information and information systems. There's this line, the technology line, but it's no longer a separable line in any way, right? Because the technology that you're using every day is the means by which you learn everything about the world, communicate everything about the world, interact with other people, do business, shop, figure out where you're driving and everything else. It's so integrated at this point. In Western societies, there is no differentiating line. And that's something that people haven't gotten used to yet. And in fact, one of the things that I discuss with the folks at Tech Vision Research, where I'm a, whatever it is, consulting, senior, super, whatever, wizard analyst, we brought this up in some of our internal discussions, the question of scope. So you have somebody that's in charge of cybersecurity. What does that mean? Are they supposed to be doing sales and marketing? Are they supposed to be countering the marketing of other companies?
Are they supposed to be countering people on the internet who are saying bad things about the company? Are they supposed to be countering people in the company who are saying things about the company to other people? The scope of that job is now so vast, it's probably beyond what the CEO ever considers, right? And so where do you draw the line? But the question isn't just a sort of a philosophical one. The question is, from a practical standpoint, if you're the chief information security officer of a corporation, you need the designation of those specific responsibilities. You need the boss to say, here are your duties to protect. Here's what you're supposed to protect. Here's how far you can go. And what's my budget for that, right? So if my budget's like $2 million to protect, you know, $100 billion corporation across the full spectrum, it's not going to happen. And then there's all these other titled positions within the entity that you interact with. All right, so we're getting away from John, but we're going to get back to John because you know what's going to happen next, right?
I can only imagine.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. According to many Chinese women who contact me on LinkedIn, I must be the best friend they could ever get. It seems LinkedIn has become the platform of best hope for Chinese honey traps. It always starts with a request to connect so they chat with you. Next step, most of the time, is to get you to contact them on an app platform, such as WhatsApp. Then, assuming you do so, you'll be engaged in a conversation leading down the path toward sharing pictures and so forth. Eventually, you may fall in love, and then, of course, you are trapped. But recently, they've been changing their tactics. Here's an example.
Fred Cohen, I really enjoy reading your articles. The article you shared a week or two ago about the future of data journalism was quite thought-provoking. I would love to stay in touch with you and learn more about your work.
Now, it's worth noting that I haven't written an article about that for a couple of years, but, you know, I guess she thought it was recent or somehow their intelligence screwed up. And, of course, this is now focused on, oh, I love your work, show me more about your work. Her identified profession, according to LinkedIn, is a jewelry designer, but okay, so it goes. So I responded, thanks.
Do you have any interesting plans for today?
To which I said, no different than any other day.
I saw your career information. Can you share some knowledge and experience?
To which I said, I do so all the time. Read the articles on all.net and a2e.co as a starting point and sign up to our mailing lists. Join our free advisory calls monthly.
So what are your new perspectives on your current career?
To which I said, no new perspectives.
So what did you gain the most today?
To which I said, nothing.
Okay.
Now, usually at this point, they give up and go on to their next target. But fear not, another one will come along. But in this case, I started to get poetry, or I guess as she called it, morning greetings.
The morning sun is bright. The morning dew is crystal. The morning flowers are beautiful. The morning air is fresh. The morning mood is soothing. Good morning to you.
So I said, thank you for bringing some poetry into my day.
No, it's not poetry. It's a morning greeting. 10,000 bright futures are no match for a warm present. Every real present is the future we once imagined. May you fall in love with the present and dream of the future. Good morning.
To which I responded, good morning.
Good morning. Have you enjoyed your breakfast?
I haven't responded after that point, but I think you get the idea. It's going to be a stream of these until she gives up.
Your efforts today are the ambush of luck, and this moment is the flowering of tomorrow. Let's work hard with hope and wait for the good to come. Good morning.
And I guess it's very pleasant and very nice, but it's a little bit strange.
Be a sunny person inside. Be strong. Be close to the sun. Be a better version of yourself. And don't need too much praise from others because you know how good you are. Good morning.
And so a little bit strange to me means, okay, they're up to something and they've changed their tactic a little bit. But this is not the first time I've engaged in this process.
Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. Fred here. On May 2nd, our monthly free advisory session will be held at 9 a.m. Sign up at a2e.co. Right after that session, we will have our RSA conference follow-up call for early-stage cybersecurity companies. Email me for an invitation. On May 9th at 9 a.m. Pacific, go to Angel. Pitch your company, get listed in our global directory, and appear on the Cyber Show next month. At 1 p.m. on May 9th, we will be discussing what we found at the RSA in our monthly L.NET advisory call. Sign up to our mailing list or email me to get your invitation.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Talking with Simpson here, who has a long career, both as a cybersecurity, we'll call it threat actor for the moment, and as a journalist.
Okay, so what was your dissertation?
Oh, gosh. So there were two things that I was working on. I was interested in, at that point, I had published multiple books on computer security, and it was very clear to me that most security problems were usability problems, that the systems were just not properly configured, that the tools were too hard to use. So my dissertation was on usable security, looking at approaches, at patterns that could be used to make computers more usable. And the two big research projects I did for that, one on how to make an encrypted email easier to use. It turns out it's really easy to make encrypted email easy to use, but use these.
People won't do it anyway. It turns out easy to use doesn't flip the switch.
It turns out it has to be completely automatic, and that was...
And not just automatic. It has to be that you don't know it's on.
That's right. It has to be the default. And in fact, there should be no way to turn it off. That was,
that runs counter to a lot of the defense mechanisms, both, as a police law enforcement, national security sort of thing, where they like to be able to read all that. And then, but also, for example, in detecting malicious things sent through emails, if you can't decrypt it, you can't detect it. So that moves the detection to the endpoints instead of to the infrastructure and creates other complexity problems as well.
We didn't care about that.
I'm just telling you, there are greater market forces that work against the things that seem to make sense.
Absolutely. And so I ended up, the other project I did was when we were working on the multi-line more dialer, we needed a telephone switch and we needed computers to call to simulate a city. And so I bought a whole bunch of computers. And when I bought them, they were all used because that was cheaper. And they had data on them left from their previous users.
Ah, yes.
So one of the previous users had been a law firm and I had their file server. One of the previous users had been a...
So much for confidentiality.
Yeah. Because one of the previous users was a novelist, a rather famous novelist. And I had drafts of an unpublished novel. One of the famous users was an organization that was delivering mental health services.
So you resisted going into the extortion. Oh, I'm sorry. Computer security consulting business with these potential new customers.
Yeah. So what I started doing before I went back to grad school was I started just buying lots of used hard drives because I figured this is fun. Let's see where it goes. And by the time I went back to grad school, I had about 300 hard drives I had purchased at swap meets on eBay, places like that. And I bought like a used RAID array so I could copied all the hard drives to the RAID array.
RAID is redundant array of independent disks for those that don't know all the abbreviations.
Yeah, thank you. And I thought, I could just like find all the good stuff and we could get an article about that. And there was a colleague of mine, another grad student. We wrote this article. We submitted it to the first issue of IEEE Security and Privacy magazine. It made it on the cover. It was very exciting. And then when it came time for me to do my research qualification exam in the PhD program, they said, you need to write an article, a research article in your area of research that is publishable. And I'm like,
you send them a copy of your already published.
And I'm like, I've done that. And so I presented my article, and the faculty there, one of the professors said, you know, this really isn't computer science research, and it's really not security research. I don't know what it is, but it's not that. And
yeah,
I'm like,
it doesn't count.
Yeah. And I'm like, I got it published in a security journal, peer reviewed. What did I do wrong?
Affiliated with IEEE,
yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a professional society, the same one that you accept other publications in, and other articles. Right. Yeah.
So,
still didn't count.
It counted.
Right?
That was my.
Oh, they counted. Okay.
Yeah, so I was able to get my PhD in 3 years because of that. And it's a good thing because I was out of funding at the end of 3 years. So rather than having to work on other people's research, I was able to finish mine. And now it's 2006, and it's beginning of another downturn. I keep graduating at the beginning of downturns.
It's part of the plan.
I guess. Actually, it was 2005. But so I look around, and apparently what I'm doing is computer forensics, and I find the major places that are doing computer forensics, and I apply there, and I get a faculty position at the Naval Postgraduate School, which was very lovely. You know, like I'm now like an associate professor, and I have I was promised when I got the job there that there would be generals walking the hallways with billions of dollars ready to just hand out to anybody who had a good project. And that turned out not to be the case. But
well,
it
may have been the case. It's just that your project wasn't what they thought was a good one.
Well, I was going to say it turned out not to be the case, but it wasn't that far off from the case. And sometimes you had to write the proposal before you got the money. And sometimes you got the money and then you wrote the proposal. But generally, the people in the military were very happy with the research we did at the Naval Postgraduate School. And we were able to very cost-effectively solve a lot of important military problems and even get some students graduated. And me and a few other professors there at the time, we really specialized on taking leading-edge research and actually finishing the research, getting the paper out, and then bringing working technology to the warfighter. And it's that last part that most academics just don't do. They never finish and productize what they're working on.
Right. It's now commonly called transition to practice. And by the way, it's the same with most startups. Most early stage startups, they may have a good idea. They may have all sorts of things. They may have a working technology. But when it comes to getting it to the point where it's useful in the marketplace, competitive, and they can actually sell it, they fall over.
It turns out it's a lot of work finishing that last piece of effort.
Well, I'm gonna speak of it differently. It turns out that all that creative stuff up at the front and all that engineering and science and stuff is not as difficult or as complex or as extensive as all that other stuff of being successful in business. And most engineers and scientists don't have the respect they should have for people in sales and marketing who seemingly are always lying about your stuff, but somehow make the sales and then you have to fulfill.
Right. So what I explained to people when we had the computer security startup was that sales was the most important part of the company, because with bad product and good sales, you could get enough money to fix your product.
Oh, well, but it's much better than that, right? With bad product and good sales, you could be the largest computer corporation in the world easily.
Well, there's that too. Right. But I was interested in fixing the product. I lost that argument with my management at the computer security startup, which is why the company was not successful.
Perhaps they should not have been the management.
Well, the president was also one of the leading programmers, and that person much more enjoyed writing code than closing sales.
Perhaps they should not have been the management.
That was my fault. So the company had been my idea, and then I had said, let's go out and find some people who can really help this thing be successful.
So one of the things I see throughout this is he has all these things that he says, well, they didn't work out, but I want to do it my way. And, oh, yeah, whatever you said doesn't matter. You know, whatever they think doesn't matter. I'm going to do it my way. But then it doesn't work out. And it's usually somebody else's fault that it doesn't work out. And at the end, he takes blame for putting in place the people that he blames for not having it work out. But
yep. I've done that one myself, right? You know, but.
Well, so I've come to the conclusion that it's my fault. It's all my fault. And there's no two ways about it. I make the decisions I make. I decide what I'm going to do. And the successes are, you know, due to the good decisions I made and the people I worked with. And the failures are due to the bad decisions I made. And regardless of who I worked with, I was deciding to work with them.
Right. You know, and you know, anybody out there can look this one up, you know, in Plato's Republic, Socrates versus Thrasymachus, you know, KO in one round. But, you know, everything's your responsibility. That's what leadership is. But the, you know, the whole point that is really, so when you're building a house, when you're not building a house, but you bought some property and someone's building a house for you and you're going through that whole thing, you know, people who build houses are very familiar with this. People who have their house built are not, right? When you, as the new homeowner, see your soon to be a house with shingles on the roof and walls and windows and everything else, you go, we're almost there. As the builder, you know, at that point, you're halfway there.
You know, if that.
You got the drywall up and everything else. Tape it up, everything else, right? Halfway there, right? The rest of it is a lot of work. And your point is exactly right. Engineers and enthusiasts tend to see this, well, now we've done it. And we've convinced people we won. But yeah, okay, you proved your point. And maybe that's all you're looking for, and if so, that's great. But if you really want to change the world, if you think this is something that everyone should do, you have to think about what the world is. A lot of people who are busy doing all sorts of things, and you want how much of their attention to do what? And yes, I'm sorry, it's not filing teeth on gears or lining up ones and zeros in order to follow a logical mechanical step, but that's how things work. You know, we had to figure out all of the sales, marketing, all those things, right?
But this drives back to, remember when we first started talking to him, how he doesn't care about what those other people think. He does it for himself. He's not interested
right.
in pleasing anybody but himself.
Which is perfectly fine.
Yeah, you know, I understand. Yeah. But yeah, that also explains, you know, if you're going to be successful in a business where you're cooperative with other people and where you have to sell other people and so forth, then that's not the business for you if, you know, you don't care what they think.
Well, you know, there's you know, I love our community. The cybersecurity community is awesome. You know, stem to stern, side to side is just fantastic. Well, but it's similar with other technical communities, you know, that find themselves becoming very popular and developing things that go on to change the world. Railroads, pick one, fix something, anything. And, you know, so again, if you want to, if all you want to do is build that perfect steam locomotive, and that's your goal, good, right? Yeah, and that's a strength of an enthusiast technical group. If you want to say, I want railroads to change the world, you know, and create things like the idea of taking a vacation and, that's a different goal. And it requires a whole new set of skills, and it's a bigger project than actually inventing the train.
Right. The other thing that he brought up, which I thought, you know, he didn't think was very important, apparently, was this thing where he got the all these computers that he, you know, bought off of swap meets or wherever, and they had all this content on them. And he thought it was kind of fun and funny, but you know, that was actually one of the projects that he did that was the most effective on the world. A lot of people saw that, came to understand that. He also created a set of forensic data that you could then use as a baseline to do research and experiments on and made that available to the world. And that was a tremendous benefit to the world of digital forensics, tremendous eye-opener for lots and lots of people who, you know, weren't handling the disposition challenges properly. And obviously, an insight for attackers who, you know, if they didn't know it before, they certainly knew it then. So I thought that was one of the most important things he did in his career, but he didn't seem to think it was anywhere near as important as the many things that he did that didn't catch on as well.
Well, ask any artist what their best piece was, and it won't necessarily align with what the public thinks. And that doesn't mean the artist is right, right? You know,
it doesn't mean they're wrong either. It's just interesting.
Well, you know, you talk about the, you know, the grand scale of influence operations, you know, which is the a term for all of human society, right? You know, we're all trying to influence each other individually all the time. That's what, you know, human sociology is, and on the grand scale, right? You know, I heard about Simpson's work with forensic, old hard drives and so forth before I heard about Simpson's by a long shot. I'll bet it was him. I remember way back, it's like articles and so forth. Yep, old stuff on hard drives, yes, can be kind of brought up. So in effect, you're doing the same things, and to our point, Simpson has been, involved in this stuff, and we communicate through a lot of ways. We communicate by doing things, right? And, we don't necessarily know which the most important one is. I think I agree with that one. I think that was, when you hit the national news media, or the international news media, you strike some chord that resonates with millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people for 5 seconds. That sticks with them. It changes the world in a little way. 5 years and 10 years and 20 years later, I remember that. We're talking 30 years ago now or so, right? And that's part of it. That's how we change the world.
It's such a haphazard sort of thing.
Right? Welcome to life, right? Chaos theory is a thing.
Well, I don't know about the theory, but chaos is certainly a thing. It certainly is. We were at the RSA show yesterday, and we saw a lot of great companies. For companies that want to discuss what they have to provide, or cybersecurity folks who want to find out about what we saw at the RSA show, join us on May 2nd at 10 a.m. Pacific time for our RSA review and discussion. May 9th, we'll also discuss the RSA at the All.net members forum at 1 p.m. Go to thecybershow.co and sign up. This segment of our show is on artificial intelligence, or as I like to say, ay-ay-ay-ay-ay. According to the National Institutes of Health, National Library of Medicine, as of September 23rd, 2022,
we did a short literature review on the role of artificial intelligence and machine learning in headache classification. This brings forth a minuscule insight into the vastness of headaches and the perpetual effort and exploration headache may demand from AI when trying to scrutinize its classification. Undoubtedly, AI or DL could better be utilized in identifying the red flags of headache, as it might help our patients at home or the primary care physicians, practicing doctors, non-neurologists in their clinic, to triage the headache patients if they need an imperative higher center referral to a neurologist for advanced evaluation. This outlook can limit the burden on a handful of headache specialists by minimizing the referrals to a tertiary care setting.
Yes, it looks like AI might help us to get rid of the very headaches that AI is creating. Isn't technology fantastic?
Friday, April 28th, all afternoon, the CSUMB Startup Challenge finalists will be at the Otter Student Union. Contact the IIED at the university for details. Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
Now, onto our next service provider.
Money.
Money.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round.
We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena. Okay, so we're back with Doug. And we're talking about things started to get complex. And so you needed to start dealing with aspects of risk management.
Yes.
Which I'll just discuss in terms of this larger aggregated problem.
Right.
Because the problem is you can't do this very tight granularity around things. Mm-hmm. And if you get it too loose, then things, can break in a wildly horrible way.
Right.
But there's another thing that happened along the way. And I want to get to that briefly first. And that is, when the web really came in, when you flipped over, after Y2K, mm-hmm. and things started to flip over to people were starting to really use the web.
Yes.
All of a sudden, you no longer had an HR database that said, some new person looking at a website from Vietnam is trying to, buy a parachute
yeah.
from
from some company somewhere, right? So now all of a sudden, there is no unique identity or identifier for a person. You don't know who it is. You have no idea who that customer is.
Correct.
You have no idea of what they're buying or who they're buying it from or what that means. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's the opposite of controlling access. It's facilitating access.
Right.
All right. So this explosive growth blew the brains out of this whole concept that you know who somebody is and what their roles and all this minutiae is. Mm-hmm. So how did that change stuff?
Oh, my goodness. There were a number of things that came about at that point in time. So let's go down to that turn of the century, Y2K kind of an era when the internet was really exploding. And I'm going to go back to e-commerce. E-commerce, I think, just blew everything out of the water and we've never looked back for all good reasons. However, things like encryption became exceedingly important. I had not mentioned encryption, but encrypting data in databases became really important so that we could put some things like a credit card information. I don't know if you're familiar with, what was it called? The payment card industry, PCI, data security standard, DSS, PCI DSS came around about that time frame. Where a number of the major credit card companies, Visa, MasterCard, Amex, put in place a standard for encrypting and securing credit card information on those directories and those databases that were tied to users. It became important to do that and also to start hashing or encrypting passwords that users would be able to input so that they could authenticate themselves and access the credit card info. I'm trying to say that the credit card number became, I believe, the de facto unique identifier for people. And to be able to access that credit card, you needed the user ID and password that corresponded with how that was encrypted in the system. Does that make sense?
Oh boy, does it. So now what we're talking about is forget about who it is, mm-hmm. right? Forget about where they are.
I don't even care.
Yeah, forget about when it is.
I want
all
the
stuff that used to be the basis for that. Right. Now it's just about not do I have the money?
Yeah.
Do I have the two pieces of information I need that says I'm authorized to spend the money?
Yes, correct.
Right? Yeah. And those two pieces of information are the credit card number.
Yes.
And, well, technically there's this 4-digit or 3-digit code.
Yes.
Sitting on the credit card.
Absolutely.
Which is the security measure that prevents it from being exploited. Well, hey, maybe not.
To Visa and MasterCard, it was good enough.
And the password. But the problem is I use that credit card on more than one system.
Mm-hmm.
So I have now I start to have a multitude of user IDs and passwords for different systems, all with the same credit card information.
Yes.
So now there are hundreds or thousands of different ways to access my credit card and cause my credit card to spend money.
Yes.
And while I'm associated with a bank account with the credit card, so I have to pay for it, anybody out there can say, oh, I figured out a user identity and a password, and now I can access the credit card. I don't have to be you.
Here in 2023, Fred, nothing has changed now. 23 years, honestly.
Yeah. Okay. So that remains through today, but that was a huge change.
Huge. Absolutely. Yes.
And it's not just your credit card information. It's basically everything.
Absolutely. And this is where, again.
Yeah. You can't pay your taxes without a computer. You can't get your social security without a computer. You can't get your insurance without it. You can't get a driver's license without a computer in some places these days. You can't vote.
That's sad. I can't say that I agree with any of that because I think that that separates haves and have-nots in an economic way that doesn't seem fair. But yes, that is the world we live in.
The digital divide.
Yes, it's the digital divide. Yep.
So now, we'll go ahead with your butt because there's all sorts of issues in the digital divide. But you were part of creating the digital divide.
Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't an intentional consequence, right? This is an unintended consequence.
Yeah.
So, talk about the divide. What's divided? But what's the other side of that divide?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we have to deal with reality. This is the world we live in. I have become over the past 7-8 years a big believer and maybe a technical evangelist around what is called decentralized identity. And I'll put it into the terms that I like to use is like bring your own identity, where me, a carbon life form has now the ability to maintain a digital representation of myself and all of the attributes I want to be associated with my digital representation and share them securely only with entities that I want to share them with. And in many cases, not even give them the information, but just a Boolean response, yes or no, I am that or I am not that, if you will. So I think
along with that, mm-hmm. you become responsible for yes. that identity. And if you yes. should lose whatever that mechanism is that assures mm-hmm. that identity or have it destroyed in an accident or what have you,
yeah,
then you lose all of the capabilities and all of the things associated with it.
Yeah, I know. That's where things like the blockchain replication, global replication become important. And I have to say, I don't have the answer. When your digital DNA gets wiped out, effectively, you may be a non-entity in the world of cyber for some period of time.
Okay. And there's a recovery process, which yep. also gets exploited by attackers so that they yeah. recover your identity, even though you haven't lost it.
Yeah.
And now they're you. That's yeah. a whole nother world. Okay. So hang on. I want to go back in time in our yep. next segment because we haven't even gotten through the next step in your career. So,
yeah.
Okay. So now the digital twin gets kidnapped and you no longer exist.
Well, you know, it had me thinking of, you know, the very early 90s when I was a newbie in the internet and security. You know, I remember saying on Usenet, you know, I think, you know, online banking is going to be a hit and getting just flamed to death. Oh my God, not until we have, you know, 3-factor authentication and, you know, everybody's carrying a token or whatever. Right? And of course, you know, as Doug is saying, you know, e-commerce, you know, between businesses started this and e-commerce individual on the web, on the early web, drove a lot of it because, you know, as business owners, you and I, and, you know, and responsible parties inside businesses, yeah. if I can close a deal and get your money, I'll do that.
Because yeah. money,
yes. Can I make right. the sale or not? Yes. Okay. Right.
Made the money money makes the world go round.
Yeah. What's the chance? You know, in the company C-Change, where I came up with the firewall idea that got me down this track, and my first sale was a $20,000 hard drive system to a customer in South America who didn't pay us and came back later and paid with a suitcase full of cash in Miami, as I recall, right? You know, so yeah, business has risks. Can I get more deals? Yes.
and more suitcases.
And more suitcases, right?
Yeah. The thing is, even though they give me a suitcase, I still report it to the IRS.
Well, yeah, that's right. I was just an employee. You know, I did things.
Well, so, you know, you start to run down this road of where we're going to. And, you know, we always talk about how things can go wrong, and boy, they can. And when they go wrong, boy, does it hurt. But in the aggregate, as a society, you know, we have adopted the notion that the individual just is not that important. And as important as you know, you look at the movies and the plays and not just now, but for the last 60, 70 years, you know, it's been about the importance of the individual versus the importance of the society or what have you, or the fountainhead and so forth. But the reality is that society rolls over people and people die eventually one way or the other, and society continues on. So society is going to do what it needs to do to survive as an entity. And if that means, you know, trading off individual well-being for the good of the whole, that's what's going to happen. I'm not advocating for it. Right.
Well, you know, as you know, I think, you know, today is better than yesterday as a rule. You know, today is better than 10,000 years ago and 200 years ago. And, you know, this is a trend I'd like to continue. Right. And how we get there incrementally, you know, there's probably no utopian states. You know, as you learn in philosophy class, actual utopias are not, right? They're boring, and, you know, there's going to be conflict in life and whatnot. But digital divide, economic disenfranchisement, you know, we have a lot of issues. We have a lot of issues. They're very real. You can't always look at this long-time curve. You got to act in the present. But I'm not despairing for the long term, but there's a lot of good work to be done today.
Yeah, and today we're starting to get influence operations that are really dramatic in their effects, and it's starting to get amplified, and now government's starting to get involved, and oh boy, are we in trouble.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill gets the fun, Dementals. John avoids the steps to Howard, huge. Simpson talks about using AI for attacks. Doug drums on the tribal knowledge, Rock My World. Hear what really happened at RSA. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more, only on The Cyber Show. See you then.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.